Oh, it's the big show. No, your eyes don't deceive you. I'm not Ewan Rankin. I am Paul Wright. Paulums on Twitter. I'm covering for the governor because he's out in London this week, putting time-lapse cameras on railway tracks. Apparently, I'm not really a fay with this kind of the hosting thing, so I will be reading from this textbook, which is the Ewan Rankin's "How to Be a Totally Awesome Podcast Host." How is the notice? Poor dummy. obviously, what he says is obviously be kind and courteous to your audience, maintain eye contact, and if anyone would like it, tell them to off. So, so I will be following this guide to see how we're going. Obviously, the first thing it says here is introduce your guests. So I will go ladies first and say hello to Sarah Jane. How are you, Sarah?
Sarah, please. Sarah Jane, only when I'm in trouble.
Oh, well, we don't know yet, do we?
Well, I hope not. No, I'm fine, thank you. Second show in 2 days. It's kind of a bit weird for me, but yes, it's good. We did the help show last night, didn't we, which was fun. So
really enjoyable that was, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes. It was a new show and to the network, and hoping for great things for it. There's a lot of conversation about what to do if you're still on Windows XP.
Yes.
Don't panic, Mr. Manning, don't panic.
Exactly. And following up is the ladies' favourite, Mr. Jeff Gamet. How are you, sir?
I'm doing that. And I think having the Ewan Rankin podcasting manual is awesome. Does it say anything about needing to wear pants?
There are no pants required, apparently. So yeah.
Awesome. So I'll fit right in.
Exactly. And last but not least, and fantastic panel as always, Mr. Robert Falk, the Streak Machine. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good evening, and to the listener, wherever and whenever you are, hello.
How are you, sir? Good week.
I'm pretty okay, I must say. Yeah. Been good weather, been able to enjoy the fresh sunshine and the air and all that stuff in between, not catching up on much technology news, might I add.
There's not been a lot of tech news anyway, so we're going to struggle through. So, the week in tech, there have been supposed leaks of Amazon's phone, which apparently has 6 cameras. Apparently, the 5 cameras on the front have got something to do with 3D 3D glassless kind of heads-up technology. Is that a gimmick?
Are you talking about the?
It's a load of crap, is what it is.
Exactly. Thank you. I hope someone just like get in with that. But what the hell is that all about?
I think not only is it a load of crap, I think it's wrong. Why is Amazon going to make a phone where they have front and rear facing cameras plus 4 additional cameras for 3D motion tracking? What is the end game for Amazon to have a cell phone?
There is. It's only to sell their content, isn't it? That's Amazon's model with the Fire, the Kindle Fire HD, and the Fire TV. Well,
the Kindle Fire, the regular Kindle, the Fire TV. Those products all make sense to me because they're direct conduits into Amazon content and Amazon sales. A telephone, I'm just really having a hard time figuring out why they would want to get into the telephone market. And with something that's going to clearly cost a lot more than other smartphones, because when you start throwing in all those extra cameras, well, the price goes up.
Yeah, no, I find it hard to imagine why they would actually enter that market, because they've got it covered with tablets and TV. I was surprised with the TV thing, really, because there's so much competition out there. But the smartphone market is even more kind of crowded than anything else, isn't it? So it is a weird move for them.
And then there's the whole 3D interface thing.
Well, what is the point of the 3D interface? Is that the gimmick that makes Amazon better than everyone else? Because didn't we try 3D phones before, and it was an absolute fail, so...
Yeah, I mean, why is the best question, I think. You still have the two-dimensional like device, so to speak, like the surface to stare down at, and making it, sure, you can make it 3D glasses less technology anyway, but I don't see where it adds to the general user experience and how that can, like it implied, how will that tie into Amazon earning more money in any way, shape, or form, except just selling another doohickey and it's neither a Kindle tablet nor a Kindle ebook reader device. It's a very puzzling thing in the whole, I would say.
Yeah, no, it literally give it to kind of separate them from everyone else, so I don't really understand that. So, but talking about phones, the Galaxy S5 was released in the UK this week, and apparently 99% of all sales were 4G contracts. So do we feel that 4G is now the way to go? And Jeff could probably illustrate this better, because obviously 4G is more prevalent in the US. But if you were buying a new smartphone now, is 4G a kind of essential now?
I don't get how 4G can't have already become a huge thing where you are.
I think
in so many ways, the United States ends up being behind in phone technology, and we have 4G rollouts all over the country. And once you have that, you get really pissed off when your phone drops back to a 3G connection.
Yeah, it's still dropping back to edge here. So the rollout in the UK is just so slow. It's always the worst thing, because they always roll out to the major kind of the big cities, London, Manchester, Birmingham. I think with 4G, it should actually roll out to the places that haven't got very fast internet connection. But they always roll out to the city, so places like Norwich, where I am, is only just rolling out now. But it's interesting that people are, I don't know if they're packaging the phone with 4G off the bat and people are getting without knowing what they're buying. But obviously, if people are opting for 4G, it's very interesting that people are jumping on it straight away in this country, because it's not very prevalent.
When I bought my first iPhone with 4G support, so it would have been the iPhone 5, there was no 4G support in Denver yet, which was just crazy. Mm. I bought it, paid for a 4G contract, knowing full well that I wasn't going to be able to take advantage of that when I was at home. But I travel often enough that I knew that I'd be able to take advantage of it when I was in other cities. And then it didn't take that long, really, before I had 4G in Denver, and then now it's in Boulder, and it's even made it all the way up to Estes Park, which is quite surprising since it's kind of isolated in the mountains. But, man, once you have that 4G connection, it just really pisses you off when you fall back to something slower. Trust me.
Yeah, I can well imagine. I mean, I don't know what the situation is in the States where you have got it at the moment, but is the charging for that still as expensive as it was when it was first released?
No. It's the price that I pay to have my 4G data is marginally higher than I paid for my 3G.
Okay.
It's low enough, or it's a small enough increase that I saw it, but if I hadn't been paying close attention to my phone bills, I could have missed noticing that it was there for a couple months.
Yeah. Do you have the ridiculous data caps that we have over here? Because I think sometimes for some of the EE and things, it's kind of like 2 or 4 gig cap on 4G. Does America have like really low caps on data usage?
I think our caps are too low, although you can get plans that have a lot more data on them. With the near ubiquitousness of Wi-Fi connections, open and free Wi-Fi connections around here, you end up not having to use your wireless data plan as much as you would otherwise think. So my data cap is, oh crap, I can't remember. Well, it shows you how much of an issue it is, but it's a fairly low cap. It's less than 5 gig, and I never worry about going over.
So that's enough for you, is it? On 4G, because the worry has always been that obviously if you've got higher speeds, you'll download more stuff.
Yeah, that's where I was coming from with it.
Oh, sure, and I do download more than I did before, but not so much that it's an issue. And with Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, so readily available pretty much everywhere I go. I mean, I'm jumping Wi-Fi networks all day long.
So that's probably the thing then, isn't it? But yeah, it's just interesting that obviously in the UK it would be that a lot of contracts will now be sold with 4G. So it's just interesting that obviously with the S5 that 99% of those contracts are being sold with 4G. So that's just interesting to see across the pond how that kind of works. So
yeah, I think it's a little bit more established there, and I think that's probably why. I think over here we are just starting to see. It is the prices are starting. There's a bit more competitiveness in the market from when we just had EE, which is what it was when it started, and it is getting a bit more competitive. But I still think it's got some way to go. Personally, I'm not going to go anywhere near 4G until it has actually stabilised a bit. Exactly. Price-wise, that is.
Exactly. I'm really surprised that you don't have a bigger rollout yet. I mean, geographically speaking, it shouldn't be that big of an issue. I mean, the UK is kind of like small and compact.
Yeah.
You mean the UK or the US?
The UK.
The UK.
Yeah, okay.
No, it's very slow over here.
And I'm about to sound really stupid or very ignorant. You guys don't have tall mountains in the UK.
No, we don't.
Okay, there you go.
Not most of the country.
Yeah, so you don't have... have big land obstacles to prevent you from getting those 4G towers where they need to go.
No, I think it's just purely about the... I think the thing is the mobile networks got really badly burned with the 3G licenses that they paid the government, and I think they've just been a bit more savvy this time. And therefore, they're being a bit more careful with the investment that they put into it, and they're doing it a bit slower. I think from memory, when the 3G licenses were sold, I think they thought it was going to be the mobile phone companies paid stupid money for it because they thought it was going to be the best thing since sliced bread. And yes, they made a lot of money on it, but it was not quite worth the money that they paid for the licenses. So that I think they're being a bit more careful and considered with it this time, which I think is probably the right thing to do. It's a bit frustrating if you don't live in an area that's got 4G, but
yes,
it's more sustainable, I would imagine.
Yeah. Now, for us, the carriers have been like scrambling to make sure that they have big 4G deployments just across the whole country. Mm. And for them, they see it as the tool to keep the customers that they have and draw in new customers because. Everyone here wants 4G. It's the thing.
Really?
That shows the difference between us, doesn't it? Because it's so slow here. Most people don't know what 4G is.
Yeah, and here there's commercials on television where each of the carriers is saying, we have the biggest 4G network, and they're putting up maps showing just how massive their coverage areas are and how bad everyone else's coverage is.
To be honest, sorry, Jeff. I was going to say, I think part of the reason why it hasn't had quite so much the take-up that it will have done before is because, you know, I was thinking about my nephew and niece who have both got mobile phones, which only have, I think they've only got mostly Wi-Fi because they're pay-as-you-go. And most people use Wi-Fi because it is a lot more, there's a lot more Wi-Fi around now than there was when 3G licenses were released. So that's why I think it's maybe not quite such a clamour for it that it was before.
Probably right, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. But for us, people are crazy for 4G, even with the easy access to free Wi-Fi.
Yeah. No.
Maybe it's just... an American gluttony thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But I mean, I mean, most of the usage I use for my phone and tablet is, even when I'm not at home, is on Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
I'll use 3G because I've got a contract for 3G and it's fine and I've got good data. I think I've got unlimited usage on it. But it doesn't particularly worry me if I haven't. I can wait. Maybe I'm just patient. I don't know, but...
We... we need a bit of service. That's the upshot of it, you know.
Yes.
The rollout needs to be sped up in this country. So, I think we're just waiting, aren't we? Patiently, because we're British and we wait, and we always wait, don't we?
And you're always polite.
And we're always polite, yes. That's thank you, true. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
And we just complain loudly.
Well, some of us do.
Exactly. So, my third story. Oh, it's a phone story. What a surprise. Google's Project Ara apparently is going to hit us in January of next year. Has anyone heard about this?
Yeah, I picked this as my story, actually.
Yeah, so would you like to move to your story as we're picking this up now, Sarah?
You can do. I mean, the thing that excites me the most about it is the fact that it's a modular phone. It's a completely different way of thinking about a mobile phone. Google's idea is that it will encourage developers to develop modules for a phone, and they're releasing it as what they call a grey phone. It's a pretty basic module for around $50, and the idea is to encourage people to develop stuff and add modules to it in the same way that they would for apps. I think it's just a great way of thinking about mobile phones. I can see all these sort of innovations coming into it in the same way that we get this add-on and that add-on particularly for iPhones. And I just think it could take mobile phones away from being mobile phones and being pocket devices. But they'll be pocket devices, because there won't just be, it'll be a small part of it that will be a mobile phone. But there will be a large part of, there'll be other parts in it that do completely different things.
Hmm. Well, I think the concept of the modular phone is really cool. And I've been following this idea for a while, because there's other companies that have proposed this. And I think it's going to fail miserably.
Really?
Because, yes. Because if... okay, so I use my parents as a litmus test for technology. And if it's something that they're not going to be easily, or if it's not something they can easily learn and integrate into their world, it doesn't happen. And I think the idea, excuse me, of my parents going to a phone store, picking out the modules that they want for their phone, is something that's beyond what they would even consider doing. And I think that using them as my litmus test, I think that the general public is not going to get on board with modular phones. And what we'll end up with, if this works at all, it will be companies that will use this as a way to just build stock phones from commodity parts.
So I think it's really exciting. I mean, I can see, not just as a developer, but the idea of having a device in my pocket that does 15 different things, it's not just a phone. I know that it does a few already.
Oh, I love the concept.
Really idea. But, I mean, you know, I can't, with all due respect to my mum, and I can't imagine using her as my litmus test, because she's still got a basic non-smartphone. It's, you know, but I think kids will absolutely love this idea. I think that's where, young people, that's where the true market will be for this sort of thing. Once they grasp the concept, I think it will actually...
Build plug-and-play phones.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that a Lego?
It is. That's a great way to describe it, Paul, yeah.
You know, you can just add bits to it as a way... You know, it is the nerd phone. It's kind of the way that the Edge phone from the Ubuntu phone came out. It was called the nerd phone. And it died and fouled on Kickstarter, but I think it will be a nerd only phone. But I think there is definitely some kind of traction for people to get into this, because developing those modules that you plug in, that could be a big market. But like Jeff says, it probably will fail, because the general public aren't really into that.
Well, I think Google have got the clout behind them, you know, to, if anyone's going to get anywhere with it other than Apple, I think Google certainly have got to give it a fairly good chance. I mean, they're already starting to organising conferences for developers to try and get them on board to actually, you know, start looking at building things ready for the launch in January.
Yeah, and that's really smart. Jumping on it now, and I agree, Sarah, that if anyone can make this work, it will be Google. And I also think this, if it succeeds, it's going to be a niche product for the nerd market
to start with. But this is one of the things I like about Google, particularly, is because they make, it's not their mainstream. You know, that we all know that they make most of their money on ad revenue, and that's been an interesting story about that this week. They can afford to speculate and do things like this, and they're throwing this out there as a possible idea, and they're willing to put some money behind it and give it a go. But it might be one of those things that it goes through several iterations and different concepts of way of doing it before something that actually hits and grabs people's imagination, it takes off.
And we have to look. We have to look at like the old original Android phones, the G1. I mean, that looks relatively nothing like any contemporary Android phone we find on any market today.
Absolutely. With
the like rotating like screen and the built-in physical keyboard and stuff. I mean, that's gone the way of the dodo. So in that aspect, the Project Aura might have a huge potential, but in the beginning, it's most likely going to be, like you said, the niche, the nerd, like the not the main market.
Yeah,
but give it a couple of years, it could actually be at least bigger. Not taking over, but it could be sufficiently big to be warranted, and it can make some really cool stuff happen.
Yeah.
Like you said, modular design. We can have real tricorders, theoretically. Yeah. Why not? Mm-hmm.
You can just see an interesting thing happening here, though, can't you? Where this evolves over time, maybe over a year or two, into different, different versions of it and stuff. And then somebody at Apple says, aha! You know, and thinks of an idea to build on top of it and brings out an absolutely killer device.
Mm-hmm. And that in turn inspires even more people to build even more awesome devices.
And if you just keep the lawyers out of it with the patent lawsuits, then we'll all do really well out of it.
Exactly. But we can live in hope.
Yeah.
I like to be a Star Trek-like optimist.
Yeah.
So they're talking about eye trackers and things like that, the modular design. Is there anything that you'd like to be able to plug into your phone right now that would kind of enhance your experience?
Personally, I've not really thought about it, but I'm sure there are things I could probably come up with.
I'd like more sensors in general, I would say. Measuring anything like infrared spectrum, why not? EM radiation, temperature. I mean, even such a simple thing, that would make a pretty interesting addition. I mean,
I would like that too.
Yeah. I mean, extending the complete functionality of the device as a whole.
Mm.
It'd be really cool.
Certainly. It's just interesting how that would evolve. So, it's the idea that the nerds have, who are going to be able to buy this phone, they are kind of going to push the kind of development of what is going to be devised for this. But I think a cheap phone that is, you buy it for cheap and then you add the kind of expensive add-ons later, you get your own personal experience. And the one thing we don't get with smartphones nowadays is a personal experience. We get what the manufacturers tell us what we want to have or what they think we need to have.
Particularly if it's an iPhone.
Yes.
There's no room for innovation there. It's the Apple way or no way, where at least with Android, and I'm not having a go at Apple as I normally do, but it is a common point that obviously with the Android being open source, it does actually provide the space for innovation.
Yeah, but then the other thing is, obviously with Android and iPhone, it's all about the apps. But if you can influence the hardware, that makes a whole new ball game, isn't it?
Yes, I totally agree.
So yeah,
and we can just like quickly mention the British success there, Raspberry Pi.
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
that's done pretty well.
I've got mine sitting over there. I can't grab it because it's all wired up, but it's absolutely brilliant.
That just shows what you can do with a very small bit of technology, and just do what the hell you want with it, really. And there should be more tech out there the way you can just do whatever you want.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Exactly.
So that's brilliant. Mr. Falk, have you got a story for us, sir?
Yes, fresh out of Japan, Toshiba has announced a new interesting laptop. Main feature, it has a so-called 4K display. So we are now firmly in the land of really, really high resolution displays, even on our laptops. I wonder, though, is this all that necessary, per se? I mean, I would say that the so-called full HD display, that's not too bad. But of course, no, more is always nice. So yeah, it's not a bad device otherwise, it seems, from the specifications. But yeah, killer feature, 4K.
Yeah,
you know, on a small screen, I question the value of 4K other than a marketing gimmick, because there's a point where we can't discern any more resolution with our eyes. Mm-hmm. So on a screen that size, is 4K necessary?
Isn't there a thing out there that 4K is only useful over a certain size anyway? Because I think it's only
yes,
50-inch screen or something like that.
Well, okay, so what I was told at CES 2 years ago is that to really be able to tell, your screen needs to be 80 inches. But when you're above 50 inches, you can tell. It's just that you're not getting the full benefit of what 4K offers.
Hmm. So what is?
And that's crazy to say 80-inch screens is what you need to go to.
Yeah, exactly. I was at the gadget show in the UK this Saturday, and I saw 4K screens. I saw them at a distance, but they looked amazing. But you can imagine on a small scale screen, you would never get the benefit. You would have to have it on a larger screen. So, in the same way that kind of Amazon's doing 3D for their phone, is Toshiba just doing another gimmick just to sell laptops?
Yeah, I'd also worry about the GPU needed to. Mm-hmm. Well, in such a small device.
And how long is your battery going to last?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Plus the heat from the GPU.
So you can have poor battery life, and you can get burned thighs while you look at those deliciously wonderful-looking pictures. Great.
That's a feature.
Good deal.
But then, obviously, the question I ask is the cheap, obviously, it's a Windows device. Is Windows 8 pushing out content 4K in the operating system? It's not, is it?
Not familiar with how Windows 8 does that, to be honest. I would assume that they would have built it for the future more than the earlier versions. So I would hope that they have some kind of support for super high resolution displays built in. But
yeah.
Your guess is as good as mine on that one.
Exactly. No, I have a history of people who buy Retina MacBook Pros, especially the early 15-inch versions. And the first thing they want to do is put Boot Camp on them in Windows, and Windows 7 just goes, oh my jeez, what the hell is going on with this? Because
mm-hmm.
it has no idea how to deal with that display. Mm-hmm. So obviously, the question is 4K content? And we really haven't got any 4K content to really to go with. I think Netflix is dabbling with 4K this year, I think.
Mm-hmm. Most of it is still on the experimental plane. Even I think there's some transmissions in Japan now on 4K, but on 4K, but I don't think it's constant. It's still testing. So, yeah.
I saw my first 4K display this weekend, and I've heard all the people everyone talking about it, and I saw it. It does look amazing. It really does look amazing. That wasn't a big screen, but if you could give me that on a laptop, then yeah, I probably would pay for that. But I think we're a long way off. I think it's kind of me first on this, just saying that it's differential to everyone else.
And now Toshiba here has managed to pump out the first one, the first with a 4K display. Yeah. So.
Toshiba are very good at that, though. Toshiba are where I work, they are our laptop supplier. And they're actually a very good supplier of laptops. They build some really good kit. So if anyone's actually going to try it, I would actually trust Toshiba to actually innovate in that space. So it is actually it's very interesting that they would... they would try that on a is it a 15-inch laptop? Is it?
Yeah, 15.6. Yes. And it's the new indium gallium zinc oxide panel, and it's even a touch panel apparently. So that'll be interesting. Now you can have a finger smear all over your 4K images. Great.
It's funny. It's
so high resolution fingerprints all over your screen. Awesome.
When you said 4K on a laptop, I thought you would probably be talking at least a 17-inch.
15
inch. Come on.
Yeah.
That really is not much. Yeah, I mean, it's not hardly worth it, is it?
Mm.
No. My view.
No, I have to agree with you. It's 3840 by 2160. That's a lot of pixel in a very small space.
Yeah.
It probably looks amazing once you've got the content, though.
Mm, most likely.
Sure it does.
So, but like you say, with Windows 8, it's that smear over the screen with the with the touchscreen. I work in a scientific institute, and you work in a scientific institute because everyone's screen has fingerprints all over the screens, all the iMacs, everything, because they're scientists, and they go, oh, you look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Press that. And fingerprints really, really bug me. They really bug me. I'm constantly cleaning iPads and Windows 8 devices for people.
I'm with you.
Yeah. It is the one thing. I love the touchscreen thing. And we get into, I'm going to talk about the Surface later on, but the fingerprints on devices really, really gets me. And obviously, there's no way to defend against that. We're human beings. We secrete oil and we put it on. But everywhere I go, there are fingerprints everywhere. And obviously, on this screen, it's going to encourage people to touch it even more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful image. Oh, I must say. Yeah.
Exactly. But no, I would love to see one and just see how it looks. But yeah, like Jeff said, if 80 inches is the minimal for 4K, it'd be interesting to see what
it's
looks
a really
like.
Big laptop.
It's a really big laptop. I would love to see the 80-inch SIBA laptop.
We need to send them an email about that, I think. They will probably build at least one of them. But, I mean, otherwise, it's a pretty well-stocked machine. I mean, it has a Core i7 CPU. It's got Radeon graphics, 8 gigs of RAM, no standard stuff, Blu-ray, all the Wi-Fi you can imagine, and some you can't. I mean, it's a good machine. I'm just... 4K. Hey, we had something extra we could put on our checkmark list, so why not?
Yeah, the thing that always gets me, obviously I order a lot of laptops, is at the bottom, the size is there, but there's a bit, it says weight, 2.4 kilos. We just cannot get away from that 2.5 kilo limit.
Mm.
We just cut, in 2014, hey, how are we not getting away from 2.5 kilos on a laptop with the technology that we have? Because we've got Retina screens on iPads, but we're still putting 4K screens into a laptop that weighs 2.5 kilos.
They just don't want them to be moved around much. That's simple as that.
It's the workstation replacement, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say it's a workstation rather than the laptop, really, isn't it?
Mm.
Exactly. So
a luggable rather than the laptop.
Yeah, because it's got Blu-ray. That's probably where the screen's going to do the most work is the Blu-ray drive, isn't it?
There was also this, they got Adobe Photoshop Lightroom 5 pre-installed, so it's kind of aimed at the photography and that kind of stuff as well, apparently.
Oh, really? No subscription required?
It's some image management software, they say here. I don't know if it's some special version of it or if it's something stock standard. I am not that familiar with Adobe's products anymore, I'm afraid.
I would guess it's a special version.
Mm. I was going to say, because there's been a lot of argument about Adobe and their free versions of iPad software and subscription models, haven't they, this week, so all the last 2 weeks. So it's interesting. No, it's interesting that people are playing with that technology now because it's not making it to... I'm in the market for a new television, and it's not 4K is making it to the kind of shops that I go to buy my television, so it's interesting making two laptops this early. So good on to see if I give it a go.
I'm shocked at the price drop already in 4K in general. I mean, now we have full HD TVs, they're practically giving them away in the cereal boxes, but 4K has dropped dramatically in just, I think, 12 months. It's way faster than even the first LCD panel displays or TVs almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, if I look at what I paid for an HDTV 5 years ago, I can get something twice the size now for less than I paid for it. You know, so 4K will always go that way. And obviously, if the prices start going down in the way this laptop's doing, then obviously, it probably will just be a feature. Yeah. So, but now I will take something not knowing, and someone could probably correct me on this, 4K compared to Retina display on a MacBook Pro, what is the difference, or are they much the same?
No, it's at least twice the resolution of Retina display.
Really? So that is really sharp then, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't think you can tell.
Yeah.
Because, our eyes just can't pick out that level of detail.
Because you can tell on a Retina iPad and a MacBook Pro that is a Retina display, because it's so obvious, isn't it? I have a standard iPad Mini, and I've seen the Retina iPad Mini, and I'm just like, that is so much different. You can really tell, can't you?
Oh yeah, it's striking.
Yeah, but well. Good luck to Toshiba. We'll let them give it a go. If I get one in, I will push people to buy one at work so I can review one, and we'll see how we go. But good on them. Mr. Gamet, do a story for us, sir.
So it's no secret that when I can find something that's a little bit different in the technology world, I will. And so I have. And so the deal is, the Netherlands is apparently trying to make their country look like Tron, because they have developed a system where all of the stripes on the roads light up at night.
Really?
Yes. Oh. And so it's glow in the dark, and I will drop this into the chat room, and it uses solar power, so. The road lines are visible during the day, and they're absorbing solar energy, and then they glow at night. And these membranes, whatever, that are in the road, they also have other icons that will light up on the road as well. So if it gets really cold and the road might be icy, you'll see these big snowflake icons start to appear on the road. Nice. So you have all of this visual feedback while you're driving at night without having to put any of it into the car itself. It's just there for all the drivers on the road. Nice. And I saw that and I was like, oh my god, it looks like Tron. This is so cool. I want to go to the Netherlands and drive around at night.
It really does, doesn't it? That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it does look fantastic.
And I think it's brilliant, and why haven't people thought of this before?
Hmm.
So that's perhaps the best question.
So how does that work then? So is it technology in the road itself, or technology that the car has to have to...
It's all in the road. It's not dependent on the cars.
Oh, wow.
It's a special paint.
Yeah. So the paint for cold weather, well, when it gets cold enough that the road might ice over, then that paint will start to light up, and you'll see the big snowflake icons on the road.
That is...
It's fracking cool is what it is.
Yeah, about right.
So, they've got a video as well. Oh, so that is...
So it's better than heads-up display, because it doesn't require any technology in the car, and it doesn't require anything once it's down, anything other than sunlight to make it work.
So it's reflective.
It's glow in the dark. So yeah, it's more radiative.
Yeah, I was going to imagine it will need the car's headlights to activate it. Because if you look in that picture, of the second picture, if you scroll down. The car, where behind the car, you can't see any snowflakes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so maybe part of it does require the headlights of your car.
Hmm. In the same way that cat's eyes do now.
But that is... See, that's the
but
sort
still,
of thing...
It's that's fracking sort of, awesome.
That's the sort of thing you need, isn't it? That is kind of, you know, in-your-face kind of, you know...
I love tech that makes driving safer.
Yeah, because driving is such a kind of, it's I say Neanderthal. It's such a basic kind of thing nowadays, and it's such a dangerous thing. So to have anything that would tell you about the conditions ahead, or because a lot of people ignore signs and warnings and things like that. If you could just see ahead that you've got, the bit I'm looking at now is the snowflakes on the road, say you are on an icy road, people would be more willing to actually follow that and pay attention to that than they would anything else.
Hmm.
So because they're showing a heads-up display in the car windscreen. So is there some technology that brings that up into the car, or is that just showing us what that
would That's the rear-view mirror.
It is, isn't it? Yes.
I just realised it completely blew my argument thing about not showing up behind. So, yeah, how does that work? Because if it's behind as well, then it's not using the headlights, is it?
Because it says here, because it's got a charging thing. The charging.
That's just to show you what, or the way it works. That's not part of a heads-up display.
Okay.
That's just a graphic element on the image to show you that it uses sunlight to charge.
Wow, that's amazing.
But they did it well enough that it looks like it's part of a HUD system.
It really does, doesn't it? But I think everyone would sign up for that. Everyone would sign up for something like that because I think they would think that, you know, I put my hands up, I am not a driver, but I think all drivers would benefit from having that sort of technology on the roads, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I can honestly say that I used to do a lot of driving, and nighttime driving on fast roads where there's no lighting is very difficult to concentrate. Well, it's not difficult to concentrate, but it takes a lot of concentration. Whereas when you're driving through areas which are well lit, it's a lot easier. So to have something like that, where you can see the lines without having to worry about where you are on the road, is would make driving a lot better.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love
it. It looks really cool.
It looks really cool. Yes, it does. That is the one thing it's open. It actually looks really cool.
The one thing that does strike me is okay, the snowflakes are really good. What happens if it's -5 in the middle of the day? Using it headlights, is it still going to glow on the road in the middle of the day?
Oh,
they've shown it at night.
I suppose it covers night driving, you know, and maybe there's a theory that the majority of accidents happen at night.
I think it's more important at night, certainly, given what I just said. But
exactly. But
curious. But that is so cool.
But it'd be interesting as if you had something underneath your car that could pick up that pattern underneath and then put it into a heads-up display as well in the daytime. That could pick up that glow-in-the-dark kind of paint or whatever it is and give it to you in the daytime as well. That would be really, really handy, wouldn't it? Just a little sensor and you get an app for your phone or something like that. But that would be really, really handy if, in day or night.
Definitely. Anything to increase the safety of driving.
Yes. Yes, I don't like driving. I'm not going to tell you how many driving tests I've had. Or how many I've failed, but
I do as many as it took me.
Give me a number and I'll add 10 to it. I guarantee it.
Oh,
well, come over here. I'll drive you guys around. I have no problem with that,
Jeff. Yeah. Thank you very much.
I've been driving. No kidding. Since I was 10 years old.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I will not give up my amount of fails, but there are double figures involved. Put it that way.
Mine's not that bad. Mine wasn't that bad.
That's why I'm a nerd and not a driver. So, but no, that's fantastic. Cheers, Jeff. So I'll go with my story last of all. Apparently, I don't know why, I thought it was interesting, Microsoft are releasing a Surface Mini. I don't know if it's because it's an iPad Mini.
So it could be a smaller failure?
Well, yes, exactly. Thank you. Thank you. You've already wrapped it up right there. But obviously, rumors are abound that it is due for release anytime soon. It's like, if you're Apple and you have an iPad, it was a huge success, And yes, there is a bit of a competition from Google with the Nexus 7 for a smaller tablet. Yes, you take your very successful tablet and you release a smaller version, which is very successful. Microsoft is taking a very unsuccessful tablet and releasing a smaller version. So are we really in the realms of them being very, very desperate now? Because there are these stories where apparently if your device is 8 inches or lower, then Microsoft will waive the...
9 inches.
9 inches, they'll waive the fee. It's like, well, but you're Microsoft. So you're now releasing a tablet that is smaller than the one that didn't work. What will the smaller one do for anyone? And hands up if you're a Windows 8 fan, and I'll take the emails after this, and no hands have gone up. So are they really just clutching at straws? Is a smaller form factor just...
It's probably just covering the bases. Google have got the Nexus 7, and Apple have got the iPad Mini, you know, and
Samsung has pretty Fire. Much the size imaginable.
That is exactly right, Robert, yeah. You want a size, we've got it.
Yeah, is that the way, it's a Samsung way, isn't it?
I don't think it is. I think, you look at what Apple and Google have got as well, and that's the size of devices. You've got the 10-inch and the 7-inch. It's a pretty standard form factor for most manufacturers. I mean, yes, okay, we've got the Samsung way, but it's like, you know, can I have the I want the 6.75-inch version, please, exactly. Samsung.
It's the difference between
the optimum size.
It's the difference between the sniper approach and the shotgun approach.
It's about right.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Almost perfect. That's exactly right. But like, you know, the Metro interface works pretty well on a tablet interface, yes. The mismatch between the desktop and Metro don't really go together. But do you want to use their touch version of Office on an 8-inch device? There's no way. I've used a Surface Pro, and it's bad enough on that. I'm surprised that Office for iPad came up before a touch version of Office for a Surface. Really, it was a really strange thing, but. Those
trying to use the ribbon on an 8-inch device.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, God, no, giving me the creeps.
Well, it's funny because doing the docs for the show today, I've been using OneNote for on the PC and on the Mac and on the iPad. And actually, the Mac and iOS versions are wholly better than the versions on Microsoft. And it makes me wonder, are they really concentrating on their own OS now, and they're realizing that the market is out there for people using tablet OSs and Macs and things like that, that they're actually concentrating more on those operating systems than they are their own?
Well, I think they are to some extent, but then I think there's also been a realization in Microsoft that they do also need to get their software onto other platforms. I mean, they've released Office for the iPad, or at least they're planning to. I'm not sure what exact status of that is.
Yeah, it's not released.
Office for the iPad is out.
Yeah, I think that's an acknowledgement of the fact that, and it's a very sensible approach, which I think is more to do with the change at the top than anything else. It's a very sensible approach, I think, and it's the right thing for Microsoft to do.
So, obviously, they have Android and
Linux.
Yes. Linux, really?
Yeah, well, that would kill off some of the other competition.
Oh, blimey, yeah, it'd be good, wouldn't it? Yeah, no more VMs, hey?
Well, no, you still need VMs, but that's a different thing altogether. But exactly. It would compete against...
But mere mortals wouldn't need the VMs anymore.
Exactly. Well, maybe, yeah.
So, were any of us ever going to buy a full-size Surface? Probably not. Do we see any benefit in buying a smaller Surface? Because a lot of people are saying it may be a contender to the Galaxy Note. A lot of blogs are saying. I was like,
no.
I would want to check one out, but I'm not sure if I want to buy one necessarily. But I am kind of the small tablet guy, so I like the smaller form factor. I don't necessarily want the huge tablet, even like the full-size, either the Google Nexus 10 or the full-size iPad. I would definitely be interested in checking out a smaller Surface, even if it is a smaller failure.
One thing I would say on that is that the reason I prefer the smaller, the larger form factor, is because as I'm getting older, my eyesight's getting worse. And having a bigger device means I can see things a lot clearer on that than I can on my tiny little phone.
So are small devices the way to go?
For those that have got good eyesight, yes.
Yeah. It depends on what you need to do.
I've got an iPad Mini, and my wife and my daughter have iPad 2s, and I use my iPad Mini. I really enjoy using it. But I do go to their full-size iPads and go, actually, this is a better experience for doing work and just generally typing. A bigger device is better, I think, especially for a mobile device. You know, iPad Mini is okay for carrying around, but for doing actually any proper work without a keyboard, then the larger devices are probably better enabled to do that.
I personally still prefer using a traditional keyboard for any amount of typing. I will still use a PC for any serious amount of typing. I will resist doing it, even on and I know I mentioned about the Bluetooth keyboards that you can use with tablets on the Help Show last night, but I would still prefer using a traditional keyboard on a PC for any amount of typing. For doing emails, tweets, social media, perfect. I don't have a problem on a phone, although I prefer using the 10-inch for the same reason I've just said. But for any amount of typing, no, it's got to be a traditional keyboard. But then I'm an old fogey, so...
No, you're not an old fogey. I love the kind of feedback from a proper keyboard as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially when I'm typing. I'm now using Office 2013, and it's a great Office suite. And people don't use Office anymore, I know they don't, but Office 2013 is a really great Office suite, and just using that with a full keyboard and a mouse, I couldn't. And I purposely log in VM into my PC at work to do work on my PC at work opposed to my Mac, because there are certain things that I can do in there that I can't do at home. So no, you're not alone in that.
If I could connect my Commodore 64 keyboard up and use that to type on my iPad Mini, I would be so happy.
Oh, the Commodore 64 keyboard. Oh,
good times.
Oh,
that was a clunk, 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 clunk.
Oh, yeah. Love that feedback. Love the sound. It's awesome.
You can't beat a good clunk, can you?
Nope.
Exactly. Well, thank you, everyone. That was fantastic. Obviously, this podcast and anything on the network couldn't exist without UK2. They do all. They carry all of our bandwidth for all the shows that we do. They're pretty much awesome. I could tell you that I'm doing that because I'm being told to say it. I'm not, because I use their services for all my domains and everything like that. They pick up all the bandwidth for British Tech Network. If you want to support them, they don't pay us a penny to do this. They just support our network. Head onto the sponsors page at BritishTechNetwork.com. Click on the sponsors link, and there are loads and loads of discount codes for you there. Check them out, because they support us, and we want to support them. The other people who support us is the Network Union. They're a BT business provider. Don't get me started on if I know what's going on with this, but obviously the best thing they do, they support the network by providing the internet to BTN Tower so that Ewan can present the shows that everyone knows and loves. It's just fantastic having providers like UK2 and the Network Union just supporting us and just letting us do what we want to do. We really enjoy doing this. And also, one more thing, there is Patreon. Find British Network on Patreon. You can subscribe from as little as $1 a month. To help us out. If you like what we say, from 60 pence a month, if you like what we do, and you like the shows that we do, help us out. It helps buy equipment and all those sort of things. And we really really thank everyone for their support. So thank you very much. And on that note, we'll go to what is the best thing, is the cool things.
Just before you do, Paul, can I just say, today I added, if you are interested in donating to us, and I would encourage you to do so, there is a link on the British Tech Network site. Now, if you go to any of the pages and you click on the Support Us link, it will take you to the Patreon page.
Oh, fantastic. That's exactly what we want. And for all the people who have supported us so far, then thank you ever so much, because it means so much to us that you appreciate the work that we do. We all love doing this, you know. No one gets paid for it or anything like that, but we just really enjoy doing these shows for you, and you know, it's just great keeping everything going. So
let's put it this way. If you think we're awesome now, if you help us get a little bit more money every month, we'll get even more awesome, and you get even more awesome in your ears on a regular basis. That is a good deal.
I want that on a T-shirt. Thank you very much. That's exactly how it's meant to be. Yes, I will wear that T-shirt next week.
I want a T-shirt that says, "I'm awesome in your ears."
That's exactly what I was going to say. I am awesome in your ears.
I am that voice in your ears.
The British Set Network, we are awesome in your ears. There we go.
And we have a short title.
I was just going to say that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is. So I will push that forward as a show title. Thank you so much. So as we round off tonight, obviously the regular thing is the cool thing is. So always ladies first. Sarah?
Oh, I'm not used to this.
Oh, I'm a gentleman.
I always get to go normally second or third or fourth. I don't think I've ever been, and any show I've ever been on, I've been first. It's fantastic, twice in one show. I am really honoured, Paul. Thank you very much. I definitely want you to host more shows.
Thank you.
Anyway, this is a bit of a first for me, of cool thing is. I don't think in all the years I've been doing the big show that I've ever picked a game, because I'm not really a gamer. But I've got a few games on my various devices, one of which is a Space Invaders type game that is a bit retro from what I remember from when I was at college and stuff. I used to play Space Invaders. I was never very good at it. This one I've actually spent a little bit of time on, and I've actually got quite good. It's called Retro Cosmos, and you can find it in the Android store. I'm not going to put a link in because obviously there's not many people in the chat room, so there's probably not a lot of point. But if anyone's interested, we will put it in the show notes. And but yes, have a look for Retro's Cosmos in the Android, in the Google Play Store.
Oh yes, that's proper old school, isn't it? That is.
It is, and it's fun as well. I've actually managed. I was never particularly good at it before, but the one thing that's different from it is that the ship that you're on, you can actually go in both directions. On the traditional arcade Space Invaders, you could only go left and right. So that is a bit of a different one. But yeah, I've actually got quite good at it.
It's got some really good reviews as well. So you can't beat a retro game, can you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Sarah.
Four games I've got on my tablet.
The thing with mobile games is they really do, they captivate you, don't they?
Yeah, definitely.
It's that kind of got like click in and play, and you know, you just play whenever you want. It's amazing. So,
yeah.
But fantastic. Mr. Streak Machine, what have you got for us?
Something that I think might have popped up pretty much everywhere online over the last 1 or 2 weeks. Project Jasper. If you know Star Trek, if you know what Tony Stark talks to in his home in the new Iron Man movies, you know the concept of the computer that you can just talk to, it'll reply to you, and you can get stuff done.
Jarvis.
Yes, exactly.
Oh.
This is called Jasper, and it runs on your Raspberry Pi, if you have one.
I do. So,
indeed, excellent. You can try it out, Sarah. It's just, well, not quite, but you know, it's a beginning. It's the baby steps. It's starting to make its way up to a computer we can talk to, and it'll actually do something and communicate back to you. It has a kind of clunky, not so good sounding voice synthesis right now, but I mean, imagine this in a few months down the road, or like in a year or so. This could be really, really awesome, and you can tie it into all your other cool Raspberry Pi projects. Why not? It's a really nifty little thing. Sarah has one. It's a really cool little computer, cheap, and you can do so much with it. Why not talk to it and make it do stuff for you?
Yeah,
I really like it.
This one is actually in a Perspex case, which was actually my cool thing here a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a tiny little board.
Mm-hmm.
It costs about £25-30, and it's basically a computer. That's it. Yep. You just have to add the devices.
it's proper. They're proper amazing, aren't they? They really
absolutely
are.
Fantastic.
That is, and obviously, I think the reason for them being developed was to teach school kids, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the idea, is to put them in schools. But they've taken off quite well in the community as well, both here and in the US as well, which I'm pleased to say. Mm. They're created by, I think it was Cambridge Labs that actually created it. But they're bringing out new boards all the time for it as well, which is fantastic. They've just bought out a new, for a similar sort of thing to what I was saying about with what Google are doing with a concept device. They've bought out a new board in the last couple of weeks that enables you to, it's a much smaller board, but it enables you to add your own things onto it instead of using some of the things that are on the board. So it means you can put it in things where you're using this inside another device. Yeah. It means that you can use the smaller one rather than the full-size one. I think that's due to come out, I can't remember, it's in a month or two, something like that.
In summer, I think they talked about.
Okay.
No, as we were, my daughter's starting high school this year, and when I went and spoken to the ICT teacher, I mentioned Raspberry Pi. He's just as kind of trying to catch him out, and he's like, "Oh yeah." In the second year, we use Raspberry Pi to do this and that. And I was like, "Oh, thank goodness!" You know,
awesome.
It's really catching on. You know, it's in the curriculum, and they're teaching kids how to build PCs and all that sort of stuff. And it's all that. You know, when I was at school, it's like how to use Word. Use Excel, and it's like, oh well, they don't need to know how to use that because no one apart from business use that anymore. But knowing how to build a computer and make it do something.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen kids using it with robotics. It's not just you know, for computers, but actually for teaching them things like that. And that's the kind of stuff I would have loved to have done when I was at school.
Yeah. And it's absolutely British. It's British.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. And made in Britain, might I add.
Indeed.
Hats off, everybody. I'm feeling very patriotic now.
Sorry, we kind of took over because that was become a Raspberry Pi pick, didn't it?
No. It's a great pick. We don't talk about it enough. You know? But no, that's fantastic. And Mr. Gamut, sir.
I feel like I should have picked something that went with Raspberry Pi, and yet I didn't. What I have... It's a new set of headphones, so Bluetooth stereo headphones.
Oh, lovely.
And, oh, that's backwards. There we go. And they're waterproof.
Oh.
So, yeah.
You got my...
So this is called the Pump, and it's from Blue Ant, and they cost $129. Rechargeable built-in battery, and you know, pretty hardcore casing on it, which you need if you're going to truly have something waterproof. And then on the ends, where the sound comes out, they're actually using Kevlar and Teflon membrane that covers up the speaker element. So I wouldn't go swimming or like scuba diving with these in. But if you're out doing activities in the rain and you're getting wet and... you know, as one does, or if you're someone that gets like really creepy, sweaty, and you ruin headphones because of that, well, this might be an option for you. And I've been playing with them just a little bit, just enough to know that that I was pleasantly surprised with the audio. Just typically, I expect the audio on products like this to be pretty poor, but it's nice. So I'll keep playing with them and report back later.
Well, I will confess, Jeff, that a lot of the shows that I listen to with you, I do in the bath. So.
Oh, well, then perfect. You can now listen to. You can take me into the bath with you.
You have been in the bath many times.
You also need a waterproof MP3 player, though.
Yes, yes, that, and.
Or just get a waterproof case.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's what you have Ziploc bags for.
That's right.
Good point.
And Paul, I feel so much closer to you now, knowing that I've been in the bath with you.
You have many a time, sir. It's been very enjoyable.
Well, I'm so happy for you.
Let's keep this clean, guys.
He's in the bath. How can you get any cleaner than that?
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point, Jeff. Well said.
Good, clean family entertainment. That's all we need on this network.
That's right.
What kind of battery life do you get out of those, Jeff, roughly?
Well, hold on, I have the box here. It has the specs on it. I'll have to tell you real world. Let's see. Playtime up to 8 hours, standby up to 2 weeks.
Well, that sounds pretty okay.
Yeah. And I will be putting these through their paces to see just how long that battery life is. I've only had these a couple days, so not long enough to really kill the battery yet.
Really cool. Looking forward to seeing what you can get out of them in the real world, so to speak.
Mm. Yes. I'll keep you up to date.
How much are they, Jeff?
$129.
Okay.
Fantastic.
I can drop a link into the chat room.
Yeah, Blue Ant also do the. They do some pretty cool devices for the car, don't they?
I believe they do. Yeah. They do some interesting audio stuff. Mm.
As Pete says, the British, the Bath Tech Network.
Awesome.
So, Jeff will now know that all of our experiences in the bathroom will be waterproof.
As well, they should be.
Exactly. Yes. Well, it just leaves me to say thank you so much to all three of you for being so gentle with me tonight. My first time reading from the Ewan Rankin
guide to podcasting.
And the last thing to say is, where can we get a hold of you, Sarah? Ladies first.
Again, three times in one show. My God. The best place to get hold of me is there's lots of different ways apart from other shows like The Help Show and occasionally other shows on the network, is on the Twitters at Sarah Jane UK. That's the best way.
Mr. Falk?
Just hop on over to streakmachine.com and you can find pretty much all my online endeavors and a few offline, I believe. Otherwise, you can just find me sometimes on the big show here. Keep listening.
Oh, and a book, sir.
Ah, yes, a book. And also, that is very much what you can find about on my website as well.
And Mr. Waterproof Gamut.
You can find me at macobserver.com and also freshbrewtales.com, where I talk about what I see in coffee shops. I posted something just a couple days ago.
Oh, that's great.
And then you can find me here and on Apple Context Machine. We have communicators and a bunch of other shows too. Google me. You'll be surprised at where you can find me. Or maybe you won't be surprised.
In my bathroom.
Yeah, in your bathroom.
Exactly.
Google me. I might be in your bathroom too.
And because I'm so excited, I didn't do a cool thing at all. I'll throw it in now. The Help Show, which we recorded last night, is a new show on the British Tech Network where we try to help you with your tech needs. Last night was an XP show, what to do while you're on XP. It'll be posted soon. There's a new help blog coming up soon on BritishTechNetwork.com, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. You'll find me at Paulums on Twitter and on the British Tech Network, write my reviews. And I will say thank you so much to my guests tonight. It's been a fantastic show, and we'll see you all soon. Thank you very much. Bye.